Welcome to Mikey Pod. This is episode 152, featuring an interview with animal rights advocate Lee Hall. I have sort of mixed feelings about the 4th of July, but in celebration of really cool remakes of Stars and Stripes Forever, this is Matmos you're listening to now. We have Lee Hall today in celebration of awesomeness and in celebration of the fact that this is my 5-year anniversary of doing this podcast. I thought it would go back to my old school way of doing things and have an activist interview. Lately, for the past couple of years, it's been just music, but let's bring some more activism. And I've been hardcore vegan for some time now, and Lee is a delightful person, so let's do the combination and let it rock. But before we hear from Lee, I'd like to play a track for you. This is Consolidated. The song is called The Sexual Politics of Meat, and it contains snippets from the book of the same name by Carol Adams. I'm not sure if this is her you'll hear speaking, but you should listen to the words just the same. Talking to Lee yesterday reminded me of this song. So here it is, and after this, we'll have our interview with Lee. Thanks for listening.
Of patriarchal values. Meat eating is the reinscription of male power at every meal. The patriarchal gaze sees not the fragmented flesh of dead animals, but appetizing food. Vegetarian activities counter patriarchal consumption and challenge the consumption of death. Feminist vegetarian activity declares that an alternative worldview exists, one which celebrates life rather than consuming death. One which does not rely on resurrected animals, but empowered people. If meat is a symbol of male dominance, then the presence of meat proclaims the disempowering of women. The notion of objectification one step further. Not only have we objectified animals, but in objectifying them, we take what we want from them and leave the rest out. We leave their death out and we take their bodies. We leave the images of their death out, but take the meaning of meat and apply it to women.
Joining me now on the show is Lee Hall, who's the Vice President of Legal Affairs for Friends of Animals and the author of the new book, On Their Own Terms, Bringing Animal Rights Philosophy Down to Earth. Hello, Lee. Welcome.
Hi, Mikey. Bod. Happy anniversary.
Thanks. Oh, yeah, 5 years. It's what a great 5 years it's been. So it was perfect to do this interview, just a little side note, because I used to, like, now the podcast is really just music, but when I first started, I did interviews and activist stuff, and yeah, there's a whole history of sort of what led me to veganism in the recordings previous
to this
one.
Oh, thank you for letting me know this.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I went to, look, now I'll just tell you right now, make it quick, though, because now I'm talking about myself and...
That's okay. It's your fifth anniversary. Go ahead.
It's true. It all started back in 19. Just kidding. I went to a protest at the Chinese consulate in Houston when I still lived there, and they were protesting cat and dog fur being brought in and sold as other animals. And so I was interviewing all these activists who were there, and I mentioned that I used to be vegetarian. And they were all, like, shocked and horrified that I had started eating meat again. And this was maybe 4 years ago. And so that made me start thinking about it again. And here I am, Nazi vegan. So, yeah. So anyway, that's the story. So now on to you.
All right.
What got you interested in animal rights?
Well, I think being an animal... You know, I mean, I think that we should all simply be interested in animal rights, and we think that, particularly now, it's very clear that our Earth is going through some real hassles because of us. So how are we going to, if we're going to survive on this planet, and if the other animals on this planet are going to survive, how are we going to perceive other animals? And we really need a shake-up of that whole idea. So I think that it's incumbent upon us all as residents of this planet to think about animal rights and what they mean, particularly in the environmental context, because that's the only way, the only place we can really find them.
People may not assume that each person who's an advocate for animal rights is also vegan. So you are a vegan as well. I'll throw you there. Your book just came out, and I think a lot of people wonder why there would be another animal rights book. What about your book is different, or what led you to write this book?
Well, a couple of things. One was that I had been doing some talks, and particularly at the University of Victoria, Canada, and a couple of students said to me after the talk, well, you know, we've read all the animal rights theory. We've read the books. They are on our bookshelves. We know what's in them. But what we really haven't been convinced of yet is that there's something in the theory that we really can bring out with us on a day-to-day basis when we're doing advocacy. And there needs to be a book about how to do advocacy, how to take the theory, the idea of animal rights, and how to filter out what works and what doesn't, discuss it, and figure out how we can actually apply it in our everyday advocacy. So that was one reason I thought about that challenge that were things. I mean, to that point, I thought the theory was all right, and that I was using it. So I didn't really, I hadn't. But they said that there was a need. So I had that in mind. And then I came across an essay that was written by a feminist professor named Catherine MacKinnon, and who's quite well known in feminist circles and also in international law, dealing with war crimes, pioneered the sexual harassment law that we have now on our continent, mainly in the United States, but also affecting Canada. So when I found out that this person actually had taken the time to say something about animal rights and write an essay about it, of course, I was very interested. And one of the things that Catherine MacKinnon said in the essay was that the model of animal rights to date misses animals on their own terms. And I thought about that carefully. And that's when I thought, wow, you know, these things click. I mean, they're a theory. Are there animal rights books that talk about how to apply the idea of animal rights, which of course we know actually comes from very old principles, but bringing that to where we are now and the earth and the environmental crisis that we're living through right now, how do we do this so that we look at animal rights in the way the animals would want us to look at them? And that's a really, really tough question. I mean, who's going to speak for the animals? What would they tell us if they could speak to us? And Catherine MacKinnon said, well, you know, is there anything they want from us other than just to let them alone, let them be? And what would it take for us to learn the answer? Well, so far in animal advocacy, the vast majority of what we were doing, of what we were thinking, of what advocacy was about, what activists were up to, was about changing conditions within industries. And in fact, if you go and look at what was on your shelves, the animal rights book on your books on your shelves, a lot of what it said was what we were going to do if we were going to, say, do incremental steps on the way to animal rights. And a lot of this was based in the industry. So no wonder so much was, I mean, there are a number of reasons why this had happened, but it's true. I mean, MacKinnon had pointed out that we look at animals in terms of how we're going to speak to each other about what treatment they should have. And what we haven't really done is talk about, say, the non-treatment, you know, how would they live if we saw them as free beings? And how do we build cultivate a movement that respects animals in their own independence, in their own power, respects their own power, not just looks at them as beings to be rescued or as victims, as animals who are suffering and who need us to adjust their conditions. Advocacy movement look like that will lead us into valuing the habitat and the needs that animals have to live out their lives with their own interactions based on their own ideas for themselves. And that wasn't really out there.
Yeah.
So then I went to work, and for the last 4 years, that's what I've been working on.
So I love the term non-treatment of animals. I think that's a really interesting term to put into the whole idea of animal rights or animal advocacy, just because we don't, before your book, actually, and hearing you talk a couple weeks ago, I hadn't really thought about animal rights meaning, no, really, we just leave them alone. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But that seemed so, like, new to me, but it really seems like to be the most basic sort of idea about animal rights to me. There was something... Go ahead.
Go ahead, Noga.
There was something in the book about, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Reagan... Is it Tom Reagan? I feel mm-hmm. like I'm doing my studies, my animal rights studies, who talked about the being in a canoe that was going under and someone had to go over, and would it be one of the humans or the dog? And and his whole philosophy about, and of course, correct me if I'm not explaining this correctly, the whole idea he had of putting the dog's value on in terms that we could relate to rather than accepting that the dog may have you can explain it better than I can. I'm getting frustrated. you know the part I'm talking about, yeah?
Yeah, there's a whole lot on that. Well, I shouldn't say a whole lot, but it's definitely examined with care, because sometimes the question really subscribed to this idea of animal rights. Well, if there were emergency, what would you do? So say you were in a lifeboat and it could only hold a certain amount of weight, and you had to make a decision between a human and a dog, what would you do? And that hypothetical question is being asked repeatedly, to the point where I think it's probably too much. I mean, we don't really need to ask this over and over. But I did want to say... why I thought maybe we were overdoing it with this question, and why it wasn't really the right question, and why we need to go someplace else now. And so to oversimplify, it says a lot more than this in the book, but to oversimplify, Mikey, you're right. I mean, I think that what Reagan and other scholars have done with that question is to go to think about this is really a situation where there's a child and there's a dog and they're stuck in a ball to exercise, and nobody's really stepping back and say, wait a minute, you know, isn't it that we put wolves in the same boat with us all the time? That's actually the question here. I mean, what is it in our minds led to the idea of the Pekingese, the Chihuahua? Now, how do we get these animals? I mean, how do we take, what do we do? Because they all their ancestors, you know, are wolves. Every dog, every breed of dog we have today, all their ancestors are wolves. Now, what would it take for us to get a wolf into the situation where they are a Chihuahua? What did it take to do that? And then the question becomes, you know, I mean, if there was a wolf in the boat with you, right, you wouldn't even be able to have these question and answer sessions, would you? I mean, the wolf would answer the question.
Right.
You know? I mean, so it's that we're even talking about a child, a person in many of these hypotheticals is kind of weird, that we haven't stepped back. I think, and I'm talking about this in a broad way. I mean, you know, we're picking up from this little story about this little hypothetical story about a boat. But I mean, I think you can use that sort of a metaphor, couldn't you? That generally in animal advocacy, we tend to look at the question of how we're going to treat animals, right, who are in these circumstances. And what we haven't done enough of, in my opinion, is try to figure out how we're going to stop putting animals in these positions of dependency on us. And then the key question becomes, how are we going to challenge ourselves to think, oh, maybe purpose breeding animals is not a very good idea? And that makes this question, who we're living with in our homes, and if we them by treating them as pets, by breeding them into existence as pets, why we live with dogs, why we live with cats. Now, you know, I live with rescued cats.
Right.
And my view, and I think it should be everybody, I think this is a healthy view, is that we should apply the ethic of care to them. This is an eco-feminist idea that it's derived from feminism, that there's this ethic of care, which means we decide the way we're going to treat other beings based on interactions we have, social interactions we have with them. And you apply the ethic of care to cats and dogs, and it works because they're already in our society. They are dependent on us, and so they need care. We need to be concerned with their well-being, and that's why welfare is not a dirty word. It's okay to be concerned about animals' welfare for the advocate, to discern, to care, to look after other animals. The bigger question becomes, once I know them, I know my cats, you know, I know them as persons. I look into their eyes and I know their souls. You know, I have a relationship with them. Then the question for me becomes, how do I respect them? Because they're dependent on my decisions. They're going to live according to the way I live in the space I occupy. And so their life is decided by my decisions. And they're not living on their own terms. And I can't really look at them as beings who would be, at first I don't call them companions because I don't think that's a fair word. I think that's a euphemism. Mm-hmm. I mean, the word companion comes from to share bread. They're mates. And I don't think that these animals have chosen to share bread with me. They needed me. They were desperate. And I helped them, and that's why they live with me. And I can't really say that this is a bilateral decision, right? That they, well, they're human companions. I don't think they decided this. I don't think some wolf long ago said, "Yeah, I would love it if my descendants became Chihuahuas." I don't think they agreed to that.
Right.
So I don't call them companions. I do talk about them as animals who are bred as pets, and of course, the ones I know I call by their names. And my question is, to respect them. How do I respect them? How do I show my respect for them? Because I'm striving for this. And I think, well, the best answer is the hardest answer. And that's that I talk to people, when I converse with people about having this situation where there's animals who we've bred to be dependent on us, and question the concept and ask people to rethink it. I mean, people will say to me, well, I wouldn't know anything about the first thing about animal rights if it weren't for my pet rabbit, Harvey. Of course we need pets because, that's how we become concerned about other animals. How would we know anything about animal rights if we didn't live with pets? That's how the spark begins. That's how Eddie Lama in The Witness, right, became an animal advocate, right? Because seeing a cat and thinking, oh, I'm smoking in front of this cat. Oh, something clicks. Maybe I shouldn't be smoking in front of this cat who has no choice but to breathe the same air. And then from everything else, here comes Eddie's life. You know, here comes an animal advocate. So why would we say? Why would we challenge this idea? I mean, aren't they? Isn't this the best situation that they could be? And they're if we care for them correctly, and so then we get back to this question of are we looking? I'm not saying I don't love the dogs and cats, and I do understand that other people, other advocates, love the dogs and cats. And they see them as individuals, if you like, persons. But is that, do we need to ask ourselves a deeper question than that? And when we look and we do our research, we find out that it's only been in the last couple of centuries that people, in general, have owned pets. That this is a new, and when people say, oh, I could never imagine a world without pets, how could it be? How could you tell me that there will never be another Maltese? Well, we could, because they haven't been around that long in the scheme of human civilization. And they started out, as pets started out in the palaces, where you'd have these very wealthy people who were, you know, running kingdoms, right? And they wanted to show their excess wealth. They didn't need to eat. So they would play with them. They could breed them into situations where they would play things. And the characteristics they would breed into them would be just to suit the whim of the nobility. It spread out. It became something that nobles did, noble people, you know, people who were aristocrats did, that this was something that they showed off. It was conspicuous consumption. They had extra animals around, and they could care for these extra animals and play with them.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it started, and then by the Victorian era, by the 1800s, it spread out, and it became, over the last couple of centuries, something that we think everyone does. But it hasn't always been that way. So it's something, it's very interesting to question it, and I think it brings up, because we see animals as cozy, pet animals as cozy, you know, because we see these animals as someone we have relationships with us, and of course they do, we think, well, there's nothing wrong with this. And I think when we mention this, then we really come to some deep, deep ideas. We really start talking about how we're going to take animals seriously. When we see that wolves and wildcats are disappearing all over, we don't, do we? We haven't noticed it, and that's just the point. There are more and more dogs every decade. There are more and more cats and more breeds of these animals, too. And yet, look around you, and do you see coyotes? Do you see as many wolves as you used to see? I mean, they were here on the East Coast, Mikey. And, you know, do we see them? Do we live amongst bears? I mean, not very many. Mm-hmm. They're contained. And if they get out of hand, you know, we have hunts and things. And if free-living deer get out of hand, we have either sharpshooters, or we have hunts, or we have people trying to impose contraceptives on them. But meanwhile, we're converting animal life all around us into to us, including being in the position where we can look after them. This is a hard question to deal with. But that too, putting them in, breeding them into positions of dependency, is also a way of using them. Have we thought about this?
Yeah, it struck me. That question of I wouldn't want to live in, or the not wanting to live in a world without pets is an extremely, like, human-centric, I don't know if that's a word, but question. I mean, because it's really, the concern isn't about the animals. The concern is about what the humans wouldn't get to have or own, you know? And it's
good.
Disturbing.
Good observation, I think, Mikey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there were a couple of things that you mentioned there that I would like to go back to. One of them is the word welfare, because for those not really in the know, in some parts of the animal rights movement or the vegan movement, whatever you want to call it, there is a sort of the word welfare has become a dirty word. Like, people talk about welfarism and new welfarism as opposed to abolitionists and there's a lot of that sort of text being bandied about, but from what I read in the book, it sounds like you have a pretty strong opinion about the word welfare and its use. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, you know, early in the 1980s, we had a book coming out called The Case for Animal Rights by, as you mentioned, Tom Reagan. And that's where one of the books in which the lifeboat comes up. And so at that point, we had a philosophy of animal rights that was put into terms that philosophers could understand. And so that was the early 80s. And in the early 90s, we had calls to the idea of animal rights. We had calls from them to distance the movement from animal welfare. And the idea became that animal welfare was the enemy of animal rights. So you weren't supposed to get involved with animal welfare, and people who got involved with animal welfare were then called welfarists, and that was a slur, a dirty word, as you said. And a lot of us picked up this idea that we were not to get involved in anything to do with welfare, anything to do with advocating welfare. And now I've come to think over time, it took me a while to arrive at this thought and conclusion, but I think that that was a big mistake. I mean, first, why would we want to distance ourselves from a word that in everyday common language means well-being? Well, why would we, people who subscribe to the idea of animal rights, feel that welfare is the enemy? And I think, so just starting from the linguistic point, right? You know, you have people say, oh, you're for animal rights. Then you must want the worst conditions for the animals, because all you want is complete abolition of their use, and therefore you must not really care that much about what the animals are suffering today. Why don't you care? Do you want animals to be in the worst position just so you can prove your point that it all needs to be abolished? Well, that's not right. That's not fair. So you think about what you're hearing. Think about what people are saying, why they think that's hurtful. And actually, when you think about it, I mean, they have a point, don't they? And they're saying, well, because if we say, well, we're against welfare, basically, you know, we're saying we're against welfare, couldn't it be understood? Couldn't it be construed that way, that we're actually against the well-being of animals? And, you know, we're taking on this idea that if they can't be completely free from institutions, that we really don't care about how they're treated. I don't think that's true of people who subscribe to animal rights. I mean, I think that's not really what animal rights thinkers think. I mean, when I was when I was saying using welfare is a dirty word, I certainly didn't mean that I wanted animals to be maltreated. But I think that and people out there who are hearing us say, oh, welfareism is terrible, animal welfare is terrible, we should not be for it, we're for animal rights. It could be at least that could be confusing because of the word animal welfare means well-being to so many people. I think it's easily misunderstood that we don't care about animal welfare. Well, actually, I think we do. And I think that what has happened is that the word welfare combined and not in a way that I think we need to sort of unravel, the word welfare combined two completely different ideas, and that's why the confusion has developed. There are two different ideas. One is that what animal institutions, you know, let's say a Purdue, okay, mm-hmm. or KFC, all right, some firm that processes chickens to be eaten, let's say that. What they do with the animals, by adjusting the circumstances under which the chickens live, if they call that animal welfare changes, and if there are advocates out there pressing for them to have, or McDonald's, right, for them to have a welfare department or a welfare committee, or if say there are awards given to them for steps in animal welfare, what we're actually talking about is just husbandry changes. We're not talking about animal welfare. I mean, there aren't, in industries, you don't have CEOs who are really concerned about animals' welfare. They're concerned about the welfare of their shareholders. That's what a corporation is.
Right.
It's concerned about profit. If it's not concerned about profit, they're doing their job wrong. So they're not really involved in animal welfare. And what that was a mistake to use the word. Should we get involved in that kind of stuff? Well, I think no. I mean, I think the rights advocates, which I am one, we're correct on that. We really shouldn't get involved in becoming consultants to KFC. That's not our position. So far so good. But to use the word welfare and to say if somebody does that, they're involved in animal welfare changes, is just a misuse of the term. That is a change in handling or husbandry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's another thing. We could talk about welfare, and unfortunately, it's being mixed up in the whole bag. And that's, say, looking after, let's say, doing trap, neuter, return for cats. You know what I mean, looking after, let's say, working in a refuge, right, where animals have come out of the industry, we've rescued them, and now they need a place to go. Unfortunately, they do, because we do have animal industry, so we do need refuges. We do need to look after animals for life.
Mm-hmm.
So, in those circumstances, we do welfare work. Is there anything wrong with that? No, there's everything right with it. So you see why I think what the mistake was at the beginning here,
right,
was to misconstrue husbandry and to call it welfare. And that's led to a great deal of confusion. So I think when we go through this, and I go through this in the book very carefully, what I'd like to do is separate these two ideas and make the point that animal welfare is a fine idea to preserve, which the ecofeminists have used, is a fine idea, and it should be applied to animals who are within our society, who are already born in dependent circumstances. They do need their well-being attended to. They do need their needs met, so we should do this. And then there are other animals who have not been made over to us. There are animals who are out there. There still is habitat. There still are wolves in Alaska and some western states. You know, there still are seals. There still are foxes and coyotes out there. And so when we are working to promote respect for these animals, then we're talking about animal rights. And that, the difference between where we need to apply welfare and the need to take back that term, that's ours. Animal welfare is something that animal rights advocates really care about. Vegans really care about it.
Right.
That's our word. We need to take to apply it correctly and not let it be used making deals with industry. Let's not go there.
Right.
So let's apply it correctly, and then let's do animal rights. I think Priscilla might have said this on an earlier show you had, Priscilla Farrell being president of Friends of Animals.
Right.
Priscilla puts it this way. Somebody will say, why is it the Friends of Animals, don't you have an animal welfare department? And Priscilla will say, well, no, actually, we don't, and we never will have that. Because this is what we feel should be done for that. Rather than be consultants to industry, we just opt out. We just do not. We make a commitment not to consume them. So we've opted out of the use of animals in industry. by being vegan. So that's the answer to that, and that does cover animal welfare, because we're not even bringing them into a dependent existence in the first place, where what they rely on. So that covers animal welfare. That covers the industry part of it. You know, we don't get into husbandry at all. Then let's talk about animal rights. That's how Priscilla words it. Now let's talk about animals who could live free, who could enjoy their autonomy. And now we're talking about animal rights. And actually, that's a really simple way of looking at it. But I mean, until I worked in an organization that subscribes to this idea of respecting animals' ability to live on their own terms, which is what Friends of Animals have been doing for a long, long time before I got there, I was unable to articulate that.
Right. So it's such a... All of that gets very confusing to me. And I think the place where I get confused is, and I'm new at this in a lot of ways, and new at being aware of all of these things. But I do understand the other side of that argument where, where encouraging people to go vegan as like the first thing to do as far as animal rights is concerned seems like that seems to be the biggest change. And I can see what the other side of that argument is that says, well, if you acknowledge or the single issue thing and all of those things, it makes people feel like they've done something besides going vegan, which is what really is sort of the baseline, to borrow a term. Did I even say that clearly? Does it make sense what I'm trying to say?
I think you're heading into the question of, can't we get incremental steps? Can't we do things, can't we do certain kinds of campaigns that only work in one area?
I think what I'm trying to express
on
is
one issue at a time.
Yeah, it's sort of that, like trying to find some sort of understanding within myself about where I do stand with that. Like I get why promoting incremental changes can be problematic, but I also understand that not trying to make those incremental changes is saying, well, let them suffer until everyone goes vegan. I don't know. What do you have to say about that, if anything? I know that's sort of a confusing way to say that.
I completely understand what you're saying. Can we start by saying that there are two different needs here? There are two different... We need to say it... I'm not going to say it in any kind of nuanced way here. there are animals who are... purpose-bred, Mikey, and there are animals who could live in a world where animal rights is meaningful, where they have their autonomy, where they don't live dependent on our decisions, right? Mm-hmm. So let's look at it in those two different ways. If you're looking at animals who, like deer, all right, like coyotes, right, like foxes, could you do a single issue campaign, or could you say there's something that you could do that maybe you could get done in a year or 5 years that would work for them? Could we get into a campaign that sticks up for a certain community of animals? Of course we could, and we do this all the time. And maybe it won't get us everywhere. Maybe it'll only be in one national park, you know, that we get the respect for the freedom of coyotes and deer and the whole bio community they, of course, are involved with. I mean, you're always looking at the freedom of animals. There's always an interdependent thing, you know, where if you're sticking up for one animal, if they live out and they're happy sticking up for other animals, if you know what I mean. If you say somebody can't kill deer, and the reason that they're saying that they have to kill deer is because they're no natural predators, well, then what you say is, don't kill deer, and don't kill their natural predators, and then you have the answer to that. Sounds right. Very simple, but they don't think about it that way. They say that, oh, there's no natural predators, so we humans have to substitute ourselves for the bobcats. the wolves, the coyotes, whatever. But if you say, no, 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 step back, because your state game commission says that there's an all-year hunting season or trapping season against these predator animals, so therefore you're trying to have it both ways, then you see you're doing some of a holistic thing. Yes, you're sticking up for the deer, but you're also saying, hands off the coyotes, because that's part of the way animals will live on their own terms. If we didn't get involved in it, we don't have to. We don't have to become the super predators. I mean, where did the environmental agencies get very environmentally sane? Is it so? We don't have to do everything today. We can work in one park today. We can work for, if we work for one group community of animals, we're actually working for interdependent communities of animals. It's okay. You can do goal setting that'll get you somewhere in 10 years or 5 years or 1 year, and you can succeed. It's doable. Now, but we have to keep working on it, you know, when we have to foster a movement that keeps working on these things. On the other hand, Mikey, going back to the animals who are suffering in institutions, when the question there is, well, isn't there something that we could do to make their lives a little bit less hellish? I think probably one of the best answers I've ever heard to that question was from Harold Brown. You know Harold Brown with Peaceable Kingdom,
no,
the Tribe
I don't.
Of Heart film? Well, there's a Tribe of Heart film that's just come out in its latest version. It's a new edited version. It's come out to the many awards and accolades. It's done by Jenny Stein and James Levesque. And a person who's starring in a starring role is an ex-farmer, a person who grew up on a dairy farm and also a beef farm, pardon the expression, Harold Brown. And Harold is now a person who promotes and is involved with, personally, vegan organic farming. So here's somebody who who's also been involved in agricultural schools and knows what's taught there. So, and has done running an animal business, animal enterprise is something that Harold's actually had experience in. So when Harold's asked that question, and I mention this in the book, Harold's asked, well, don't you care about ameliorating, somehow making their conditions less hellish? I mean, isn't that something that we could do? And Harold says, look, the people who run animal businesses and the people who go to those agricultural schools and learn how to do animal husbandry, they know what husbandry is. You don't need to tell them. They know. Now, if we have a movement become vegan, who say we're becoming conscientious objectors to the use of animal products in society, and that movement grows, you know that those animal enterprises are going to be looking at us because, there's going to be all sorts of new products out there for us, and we're not going to be buying what they're selling, and the trends will change in society as the vegan movement grows. As that happens, the industries that sell animal parts are going to try to compete with us. And they know what husbandry is, and they know how to make animal use look good. They do it. I mean, they look at what's going on now, Mikey. They themselves are really into this whole idea of locavorism, eating animals from local farms and selling animals on ranches that they say they know the animals by name. So there's a whole market out there of businesses who are saying, oh yeah, we treat our animals kindly and decently, and they're trying to get the potential veggies to buy their eggs, their milk, and their pig products and so forth. They know how to do it, right. And they will compete. They will compete, and they will try to make animal husbandry conditions much better, and maybe they'll succeed, but to the extent they do, two things. One is that they'll be taking up more space. And the last thing we want to do is give animal agribusiness more space than it's already got in this world. What's it got, like a third of the land? You know, I mean, this is killing the earth. So we don't need to offer them more space for what they do. And also another point is that going back to when the Vegan Society was formed in 1944, the reason was because the inspiration for it was a family farm. An idyllic, and I'm using Donald Watson's word, for an uncle's farm.
Mm-hmm.
favorite uncle. This was the idyllic farm. So even if you go all the way back and get to the idyllic situation where Donald said, it's like going to heaven. All right. So say you get to back to that point where you've got these animals in these marvelous conditions. Never mind that we're ignoring the animals who are wiped off the earth so that we could do this. All right. If you get to that situation, you're back in the early 1900s, right? You're back before there was factory farming. And was that really heavenly? Well, Donald saw one of the pigs being killed one day, and the other pig beside the pig that was being killed heard the screams, and Donald remembered it all that time and said, oh, I realize that that idyllic farm was actually nothing more than death row, where every animal was waiting out its life just based on the decision of how many days that animal was useful to human beings. And I decided at that point that farms and uncles needed to be reassessed.
That's the perfect, yeah, I love that story. So it's a process. I mean, I guess part of what I think in terms a lot of what of my perception of things, I guess it's a sort of human thing to do. But I want people to switch overnight. Like there are so many times that I realize I'm waiting for everyone who follows me on Facebook to say, "Oh my God, you're right! I'm going vegan today," and
yeah,
it's just not going to happen.
And but, you know, Mikey, there were 2 billion people on the earth in 1944. And in the very first vegan news, Donald Watson pointed out that there were 2 billion people on the earth, and that was more than the earth and the other beings on it. That was more than what it was fair to impose. And now we have nearly 7 billion. And just the idea that we think that there are going to be better conditions and free range this and that and cage free this and that. Where do we think we're going to put those animals? So, yeah, I mean, when you say, oh, I wish everybody would go vegan overnight. Yeah, I mean, there's a real urgency. I mean, we could also talk about our own, controlling our own numbers, because that's a conversation that's going to have to come up.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, if 2 billion was unfair, what is 7 billion and rising? What are we doing to the streams and the air? Well, we know, don't we?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Oh, I sense your urgency, Mikey, and I think that's another reason to not compromise with this idea of, you know, institutional conditions, and to say no, they shouldn't be, because I think you give people too much wiggle room. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to all listen to us. Doesn't mean that they're all going to be converted and say, oh yes, we've seen the light, I'm going to go vegan right now. But you don't need a lot of people to have a paradigm shift in society. We've seen that, you know, the Copernican shift. We've seen that we no longer think that the earth is the center of the universe, and this is what we're. Humans aren't the center of the universe. We're not the ones who were sent here to this planet to control everybody else. Could humanity change its mind about that? I think so. And it may just take a modest amount of people to become vegan, to be in positions where that word gets out in the right places, just as it was in Copernicus's time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably an exaggeration, but there have been people in my life who surprised me. Recently, I had a conversation with a friend who I never thought would have even considered going vegan, and he asked me for some recipes. And to me, like for someone like that, who is like very, like he's even the, you know, the type of people that always have to make some sort of joke about the fact that you're vegan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's that person. But I think just through calmly being vegan around him,
yeah,
it's really started to make him think. So it's not hopeless either, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So we've been talking for quite a while, and I haven't talked about a lot of things that I wanted to ask you. So maybe we should do a part
two. But you did
sometime.
Say something revolutionary. You talked about the power of a cookbook.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
Mm.
The power of a cookbook. So I think we should wrap it up, but I feel like there's so much left to say, so maybe we can have a tentative plan to do this again.
We can have a reunion.
Yeah, a reunion show next year. Well, it's got to be before next year.
Well, you know, at that point, at that point we'll be able to talk about what people have said about the book, won't we? Because, I mean, at this point, it's listening to feedback. I mean, a lot of what went on in the book involved listening to other people and bringing their thoughts and ideas into the book. So, you know, if I had an opportunity to discuss working with, I would try to do my best to set aside a lot of time to listen to other people and get their ideas. And I put a lot of people's ideas into this book. I mean, this book is written sort of, it's collectively, you know. So I think that when we have your next anniversary, I think we'll have a lot more feedback, and it'll be interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of new ideas in it. I mean, newish. I mean, of course, they. I don't want to say they don't. But, you know, they're from other people. They're from the movement. They're from veganism. The way they're put together, I think, is a challenge that works for a world that's dealing with global warming and that's dealing with mass extinction. So it's new in that sense. And just like to hear, you know, some of the feedback and some of the discussion that arises from the book.
Yeah, look, as far as feedback from this show, speaking of, you can stop by listeners, MikeyPod.com, and leave comments. So maybe there'll be some discussion there. It'd be interesting for the non-vegans, non-animal rights people to chime in too, because I sense that there are probably a few of those who listen to the show too. So I would really be interested to get some of that input as well.
Definitely.
Where's the best place to pick up the book?
Well, internationally, it's available on Amazon because, for one simple reason, it's cheap shipping.
Right.
But we do like the idea of people buying it from friendsofanimals.org, and the reason is if you get it from the Friends of Animals website, there's nothing that goes to any middle persons, you know what I mean? I mean,
right.
It goes right into animal advocacy, and the proceeds from the book obviously don't go to us personally, our work that we do, our advocacy work. And so we have Marine Animal Rescue in California, where we deal with mainly what happens because people catch fish, you know, what happens with the hooks and the lines and the nets and everything. And we do rescue work with the animals who get caught up. And at the same time, the person who is facilitating that rescue work, whose name is Peter Wallerstein, is vegan. So that's a person who talks to other people about not eating the fish in the first place. So that works out very well. We're on the same wavelength. And, of course, Priscilla is with Stefan Tell, who is has renovated a sanctuary in Texas, primarily primates. And you can see that at primarilyprimates.org. And loads of work, and, of course, money has been going into that. So I'm glad to promote the book, and I'm glad to promote it through Friends of Animals because of all the various advocacy things that we've got going on. And then legal advocacy for animals who do live on their terms.
Well, every time I talk to you, I walk away with so much more to think about than I had before. So thank you for that.
Oh, that's the best possible thing you could say.
Oh,
thank
excellent.
You.
Oh, you know,
thank
every,
you.
After I saw your talk, oh, I forgot the name of the coffee shop where you did the talk in New York City.
Oh, Blue Stockings?
Yeah, Blue Stockings. There was,
weren't they great?
Yeah, they were great. And, of course, we can't go without mentioning Gone Pie. Gone
of course, we cannot go without mentioning Gone Pie and
yeah.
The wonderful, wonderful desserts that are made out of such great natural ingredients, organic and fairly traded. Gone Pie Vegan Bakery on the web, and they did the catering for that wonderful event. That
yeah,
great.
Yeah. So, and then leaving that event for days, I have this whole new, like, okay. So maybe this is what animal rights is, you know, like, so it's great. Lots to think about. And yeah, so anyway, all of that is to say thank you for all of your work and especially for joining me here today on the Mikey Pod podcast.
Thank you, Mikey Pod. Happy anniversary.
Oh, thanks. So exciting. Mm-hmm. All right. So we're going to end the show with this song from Howard Jones, who originally inspired me to be vegetarian years ago.
Right on.
And it's called Someone You Need. Thank you.
all the people went home, and I was just wondering if you're alone. So how have you been lately? I hear you're a little down. So do you think maybe I could come around? 'Cause I could be someone you need, wrap you in blankets on dark winter nights, be your best confidant, pay the right compliment. I could be someone you need. We had coffee on 3rd Street and talked for a time. I still have your letter, I know every line, but I hope this ain't from way out of the blue. 'Cause I got to thinking and I thought of you. I could be someone you need, keep you from burning in hot summer sun, roll you in clover, a coat for your shoulder. I could be you need someone there when the world isn't fair, or it's all just too good to be true.